The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So when people ask, what's the highest teaching in Buddhism, a lot of times the answer will be teachings on emptiness, on selflessness, teachings on not self. And in fact, a lot of the ways that awakening is characterized is a penetrating, enduring insight into selflessness. But it's complicated. So on the one hand, you have folks who will say, for example, no self, no problem. I think that's even the title of a book. And that is, as far as I can tell, true. But the question is, how much of a problem is the self? That can vary quite widely. Yeah, the self can be more or less problematic, even if we agree, no self, no problem. And what I want to try to unpack in this time, some reflections on the theme that Gil and Nikki have started tracing out about the supporting cultivations for deepening insight into the three characteristics. In a way, we have to develop some facility in freeing ourselves of the burden of self. But we also actually, quite importantly, need to cultivate a relationship with self that is functional. And so there's a line from Leonard Cohen who said, I know your burden's heavy as you wheel it through the night. The guru said it's empty, but that doesn't make it light. We want to understand emptiness, but we also need ways of working when it's not light. Yeah. Now, the teachings on self and not self are the cause of a great deal of suffering in and of themselves. On a retreat, kind of an early retreat, I remember we're in a Q&A session, and this one yogi was kind of recounting in very kind of elaborate language and quite stirring language this kind of insight into not self. And the teacher was very kind of approving, and I just sat there just like my heart just shriveling with each new detail that she revealed, because all I could do in that moment was compare myself, you know, and feel a kind of longing to want to know, but also, of course, self is totally bound up in the comparing mind and in the way we relate to these teachings. Now, even though we say some say that the highest teachings on emptiness, it's really important not to lose sight of the fact that we are, what we care about is suffering and its absence. And Tanisaro Bhikkhu said, just to drive home this point, he said, if you are not suffering whatsoever, do you think you care if you have a self or not? The teachings on self and selflessness are pointing us back to now. So this is Sam Harris from Waking Up. Our minds are all we have. They are all we've ever had, and they are all we can offer others. Most of us could easily compile a list of goals we want to achieve or personal problems that need to be solved. But what is the real significance of every item on such a list? Everything we want to accomplish is something that promises that, if done, it would allow us to finally relax and enjoy our lives in the present. Generally speaking, this is a false hope. I'm not denying the importance of achieving one's goals, maintaining one's health, or keeping one's children clothed and fed. But most of us spend our time seeking happiness and security without acknowledging the underlying purpose of our search. Each of us is looking for a path back to the present. We are trying to find good enough reasons to be satisfied now. So, when we approach these teachings, please remember that they're pointing us back to now, pointing us back to a way of experiencing now that feels like enough. And when now feels like enough, all of the beautiful qualities of the heart come to the foreground. When now feels like enough, there's nothing other to do than to love people. And so whatever the mind does with these teachings, just remember they're pointing back to now. Now, it's sometimes suggested that there's a kind of conflict between self-confidence, self-love on the one hand, and not-self, anatta, on the other hand. And sometimes there's even a kind of elaborate philosophical explanations that invoke relative and absolute as a way to try to accommodate the apparent tension between self-love and selflessness. But what I want to suggest is that there's no conflict at all, and in fact, self-love may be the precondition for a healthy release into selflessness. self is not a thing. Not self is not a thing. Self is an experience, and not self is an experience. And two experiences don't contradict each other. They're just two experiences. What we want to distinguish is self-kindness, confidence, self-love from clinging to self-view. Yeah. Does that make sense? That's the conflict. That's the conflict. This confidence or self-love is quite important, and as Gil remarked, the Buddha, you read the suttas, it appears in every sense to be a very confident person. And this confidence is quite important as we navigate the challenging or disorienting phases of practice. Actually, it starts to make the experience of anicca, as Nikita talked about, it would make the experience of impermanence feel safer. This kind of self-confidence is a powerful stabilizing force, and it may even be an important factor in what makes a difference between selflessness feeling barren and desolate from experiences of selflessness that feel liberating. I'll say more about that. Now this kind of healthy relationship with the self, the loving side of this equation, is important insofar it's how we stay safe for others. Yeah. It's actually how we stay safe for others, is to develop a more and more transparent and loving relationship with the different corners of our minds. And it's been painful for me to see the ways in which insight into selflessness does not guarantee ethical conduct. And it, from my viewpoint, it looks like that it's a kind of integrated, loving relationship with ourself that makes harm less and less likely. So we can say that the Dharma grows both in terms of depth, but also breadth. It grows in terms of the nature of awareness, the kind of access to silence and stillness. It grows in depth But importantly, it also grows in terms of breath, meaning that the Dharma starts to colonize more and more of our mind. And it's that breath that actually helps make us more and more safe for others. In the kind of famous sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says something like, she who holds herself dear, she who loves herself, will not harm another. And in my own path of practice, as I develop more gentleness and care for myself, as I see more and more deeply how simply I just want to be happy, it becomes less and less possible to forget that in an act of harming another. And so this gentle, loving acceptance of oneself in our strengths and our foibles is actually very closely linked to our capacity for deep empathy. Jack Engler famously said, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And he is a psychologist and Buddhist teacher, and he's said that, and he subsequently walked back a little bit from that suggestion, but he basically, after, I don't know how long ago he said it, many years, he's basically affirmed that. So this is what he wrote. As a psychologist, part of my effort is to help people develop capacities that may be underdeveloped or may have been derailed earlier in development. Ego, in this sense, is a positive thing. That's the way I think of it in psychology. But a lot of people who come to me for therapy don't think of ego that way. They think of ego in a spiritual context where it's a bad thing. But talking about ego in this way is problematic. It gets talked about almost like an alternate personality within me that is bad. It gets reified as some part of me that I have to battle with, that I have to transcend. I think spiritual language reinforces a lot of dualistic thinking when we talk about ego that way. Now, instead of self versus other, it's self versus ego. And so the struggle just continues in another guise. Self is a story. Self is a story, in a way. The story we tell about the past. And that story can be more or less empowering. That story can be more or less adaptive. The philosopher Dan Dennett said, ask the question, what is the self? And his answer was, self is the center of narrative gravity. Self is the center of narrative gravity. And it almost feels like it's like a gravitational pull towards some center in our being And we take that in a certain way without looking closely to be the center. But the suggestion is that this what we see is actually more narrative. Now, a lot of Dharma practice is actually beginning to rewrite the story of the self. Story has a bad rap in these parts, you know, right? And that is because it is the wellspring of a great deal of suffering. So it's earned some of its reputation, maybe. But one kind of process that we don't do so explicitly in Dharma practice is that we're actually learning to retell the story of our life in light of Dhamma. And so how painful does our history have to be? How painful does our self-narrative have to be? Maybe less painful than we think. And one of the central aspects of practice is that we're retelling the story of self. Because we've had so much experience that's only been known through the prism of the kalesas, through the prism of our own confusion. And what we do in our practice is we hear some of these teachings, we start contemplating some of the Buddha's instructions. And we sit down and we close our eyes and we make everything relevant. Everything that arises, all the pieces of our past re-arise. In a certain way, the past is all there is. Usually, we say the present is all there is, but in a certain sense, this moment is full of nothing but past. And it comes up in many forms as we sit, and it's like we need to see all of it come up, because that which we don't see, we can't bless. And we want to see more and more of our life, our past, our patterns, our habits, so that we can bless more and more of it. Yeah. And it's like we're touching our memories, blessing them with awareness and love. And so of course, our family history and our personal history, our own conduct, our own habits arise, and we're trying to, whatever the meditation object is, we're trying to meet these experiences with the eye of Dharma. And there's like a process of integration, of gathering up the fragments of self, of starting to tell what is a much richer story of the self. Ways of understanding suffering and loss and joy and conceit. Ways of digesting our past. And we do this in the present. Through that process, through that process of knowing pain, we become more confident. When pain is kind of vaguely lurking, it has an ominous effect. When it feels half acknowledged, half vague, has a destabilizing effect on the mind, erodes our confidence. But as we start to bless more and more of our past, we actually feel more confident, because there's a sense like we can't be ambushed by our pain in the same way. We have less and less to hide. We can't be found out. And the heart kind of relaxes. Confidence and self-love unfold in a number of ways. There's, of course, this this community, and some of what we learn in Sangha is that we actually start to see ourselves through the eyes of others. You know, like how do others see us? How do they look at us? And we actually start to sense a kind of to know ourselves in a new way. We usually think our real self is like what we do alone in our homes or something, but we actually start to learn a kind of new parts of ourselves in community, and to have that reflected back by others. To develop this sense of belonging, which is so fundamental to being human. And so it's said that the Dharma is like moonlight, and Sangha is like those people who walk out into the splendor of the moonlight together. There's a confidence that develops when we start to trust our path, this path, deeply. This is a real turning point in practice. In a certain way, there's often a phase or phases of practice where there's just some kind of ambivalence, and sometimes we just can't resolve it. We feel compelled in a way by practice, our heart is drawn in a way, but there's something that's unresolved. There's some ambivalence. And something happens when the heart kind of turns fully towards Dharma, that simplifies life dramatically. And it doesn't mean that we become monastics necessarily, or devote all of our time to practice, but it means that there's a deep trust that the path of happiness is a path with heart. And just knowing that we're doing the kind of work that we're not going to regret is powerful. I've spent a few years working in hospice care as a volunteer, and one of the kind of main lessons in that time was just how few things matter at the end of one's life. You know, and looking back, how few things really matter deeply. And I know this matters. I have no doubt this matters. And knowing that endows us with a sense of confidence that we may be kind of bumbling our way through this whole thing. I'm doing my best, and it doesn't always work out perfectly. And I know this really matters. Whatever comes of it, this really matters. The heart relaxes. I don't know about Buddha nature, but we can ask the question, what's left when all of the pushing and pulling on the moment stops? What's actually here when the gesture of push and hold stops? in that sense of enoughness that I pointed to at the beginning, what comes through most clearly to me is a kind of longing not to do harm to others or myself. When that pushing and pulling stops, there's something that feels inherently non-violent. And that heart quality becomes a source of confidence, a sense of dignity, trust. In our ethical conduct, we usually think about ethics as rules, but more and more they seem, ethical conduct seems like just honoring the architecture of our nervous system. When we really start to pay attention to the kind of instant karmic feedback of our conduct, we start to want to do less harm. And as we feel in deeper alignment with our ethical impulses, as we start to feel less and less gap between what we think is right and our behavior, as that gap starts to close, the heart really relaxes. The Buddha talked about the bliss of blamelessness. The mind becomes less and less complicated, less and less encumbered by regret and indecision. And again, there's this sense of, a kind of nourishment of ethicality. There's a confidence that arises out of the ripening of equanimity. As equanimity ripens, as we as we feel more and more capable of meeting the intensity of being human, the sense that we can be overwhelmed by our inner life starts to fade away. And if you actually unpack many of our fear states, many of our states around self-doubt, if we unpack them carefully, which you can do in the silence, we may be able to see how lurking somewhere in there is the sense life may become too much. I may be overwhelmed by something. And as we develop more equanimity and the sense of as we can remain free amidst more and more different states of body and mind, as we can remain free amidst them, the fear of being overrun by our inner life diminishes. The fear of being overrun by pain diminishes. And so it feels safer, more confident. Now, all of these developments of confidence, of self-kindness, actually pave the way, in a sense, for this insight into anatta. And they do that because we could say that the self that is loved is easier to relinquish than the self that is hated. The self that is judged or hated, the self harshness that is it's really a kind of self preoccupation. And when we're really caught in those loops of self-harshness, it doesn't feel okay to put it down. It feels like there's urgent work to be done in that realm of self-harshness. It's like we're rearranging and manicuring ourselves in a way, and it all feels very urgent. It's hard to relinquish the self that is hated. But the self that is confident and well-loved, well-cared for, there's no threat in putting that down. There's no threat in putting that down. One of my teachers, Shinzen Young, said we love the self to death. It's not a battle we're doing. We actually affirm the arising of self. So deeply that we know the ground of ourself as experience. The author E.L. Doctorow said, writing a novel is like driving a car at night. You can only see as far as your headlights, but you can make the whole trip that way. And I saw that, and I thought of our path, especially retreat practice. We can only see as far as the headlights, and that's enough. And so we'll keep going. Don't try to look beyond the headlights. Just stay simple. Stay with what's here to be known in this moment. Let's just sit for a second.